reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, Dell, and AVU Technologies. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE Membership and Organization Department Director Sharon Pinnock. You'll also hear Jason Fornicola's interviews with AFGE National President John Gage, National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, and 8th District National Vice President Jay Nygaard. Welcome back to Inside Government, Sharon Pinnock.
Hi, how you doing today, Ward?
Good. So recently the Federal Labor Relations Authority accepted AFGE's petition for a union election at TSA. This is great news. Tell us about it.
It is absolutely great news. It is a day that TSOs have long been awaiting, given their nine-year battle to try to acquire a voice at work. And at AFGE, we knew this day would be coming. We certainly didn't think it would take, 9 years, but we're glad that the FLRA has finally issued a ruling that allows these workers to have a voice.
Now, I know I've seen it even on my Facebook situation, TSOs responding, people in the public, union activists. It's been a very strong, positive response to this, has there not?
Oh, yes, because for the labor movement, it represents a door open for another way to look at how we organize workers in this country. For so many years, because of just kind of the way the labor relations system has worked in the country, it's always been very much tied to an industrial style of unionism, which relied very heavily on pattern bargaining at plants and shops, and we have started to move away from that, just looking at the kinds of jobs people are doing. So this issue, which has been a really crucial issue for AFGE since the beginning of this campaign, of the role of collective bargaining in allowing workers to choose a bargaining agent, somebody who can come and represent them on other issues or bargain in other ways that may not necessarily be tied to the old industrial style collective bargaining, represents a really big change here. It says to workers that collective bargaining is one thing that a union can do for you. Unions do a lot more for their members other than merely or exclusively bargain a contract. So this FLRA, in its wisdom, recognized that unions can play a much broader role at the work site, and that if collective bargaining is there, absolutely, then the workers, when they vote in this election, they will be voting that whichever union they choose will be the union that bargains the contract. That's exactly as we want it. But in the meantime, what the decision will do is clear up all of this question that TSA says it has about who represents these workers. So the workers, through this decision the FLRA has just made, will have the opportunity to say once and for all, formally, they've already said it in their numbers. AFGE has over 12,000 dues-paying members in this TSA bargaining unit, far and away more than our competitor, which has maybe 2,000, dues-payers. So we believe, actually, that, the election is over because the workers have already spoken in who they have chosen to join. But what this process will do was to put it formally on record so that TSA can no longer put itself kind of in the middle to say, we're just not sure. Is it this one or is it that one? Workers are going to make it clear to management. AFGE is our representative of choice. And for any questions concerning the impact and the implementation of policies on this workforce, we want you to be talking to our elected representative, and that will be AFGE.
So when is that election? That's the big question on everybody's mind.
Well, what the decision does is remand back to the regional director our petition, ordering that the FLRA should process the petition. And the first steps of that process will be to collect the parties, the unions involved, agency management, with the FLRA, have people sit down and say, hey, look, this is the size of the bargaining unit. This is the kind of election we want to run. And, you know, depending on what kind of election they want to run, it's very doubtful that TSA will agree to an on-site election, as I think anybody might agree that it would be a little bit too disruptive in the workplace to do it that way. So it's going to take some time to work out these details, but we're pretty confident that, you know, January, February, at the latest of next year, TSOs will be casting their ballots.
And what is AFGE doing to prepare for all this?
Well, you know, AFGE, it's a funny question whenever I hear it. We're doing what we've been doing. We've been preparing for this day since we decided that we would take up the quest to win collective bargaining for these workers. And so what that means is we are representing people every day at the airport. We're taking their calls through our hotline. We are posting information, every bit of information we get about changes in TSA policy and other workplace issues. We're doing what we have been doing, Ward. We're representing TSOs every day. So, you know, I don't think this is a workforce that doesn't know who's been there for them from the beginning. These workers have had AFGE in their airports since 2001. And there really is nothing different to do except to have people come out and vote when it's time to come out and vote.
And how do you think this election is going to impact collective bargaining rights? Do you think that's still a little ways off, or do you think once the election's over and we start moving that it's, you know, going to be a lot closer?
I would be surprised if the administrator does not grant some form of collective bargaining before the election takes place. And the reason I believe that is I know that the agency and the White House is not interested in there being any question about whether or not the bargaining agent elected will be the same whether or not there's collective bargaining. So I don't think anybody wants to really go into the process with there being any murkiness, you know, about whether or not collective bargaining will be something that the elected representative will be able to do. So to that extent, I believe that the FLRA decision, you know, is going to kind of force the hand, you know, of the administration to say, you know, whatever form of collective bargaining we think we want to try at this point, let's go ahead and get it implemented now so that once the workers have spoken, everybody is clear that the union they elect will do every bit of speaking on behalf of the workforce.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government, and military employees. Purchasing Power has a hassle-free way for you to buy computers, electronics, and home appliances through easy payroll deduction. You can get a 16-gigabyte Apple iPod Nano or a Sharp Aquos 40-inch LCD HD TV, along with many other great items for the holidays. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by AFGE National President John Gage. President Gage, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So we've got you here today at the NBAC Triennial Convention, Training Convention. What are your thoughts so far from the convention?
Well, this has been a really fabulous convention. The level of commitment and dedication. This is our VA, our largest council, and we have our membership now is topping 80,000, and they are just a special group of people. The dedication to the veteran is just is a very strong ethic among our members. So I'm having a real good time. We're out in LA here, and this is the today is a full training day. They've just concluded a new master agreement with the VA, and AFGE has concluded a new master agreement with the Veterans Administration, and we're having a number of training workshops going over that new agreement. So the energy is high, and the enthusiasm is wonderful.
And what can you tell us about the agreement, and also how important it is to have a master agreement?
To me, especially, the contract is the backbone of what we do and how we represent people. And the VA contract truly is one of the best in the government, and it has been for the last 10 years. But these are really comprehensive agreements that cover virtually every aspect of an employee's career. You know, the merit promotion provisions, flex times, alternate work schedules, employee rights. It's a very comprehensive agreement. And I don't think we blow our horn enough, to tell you the truth. And one of the things we're going to do is take this contract back to employees and let them see the rights that they have. And I think employees are going to be very, very impressed with what the union has delivered.
And when you're talking about rights, shed some light on the Title 38 situation and the fight for those rights.
Yeah, well, this is Title 38. Congress gave this authority to the VA to be able to hire hard-to-fill positions in patient care. And it's morphed over to more than that, that the people under Title 38 have a fairly significant diminution of their rights in performance management, in overtime, and it's something that the union is working very hard with. That's part of the lobbying activity that we do, and we have a bill up to try to lessen the impact, the adverse impact of Title 38 on our professionals.
And do you think then that's where the solution will come legislatively?
I believe so. We have kind of tried everything else, and the VA simply really hides behind that Title 38 to get away with a lot of things that they just couldn't do to other bargaining unit employees. So I don't mind the VA having special hiring authority, but why that lapses over into performance management and into pay systems and promotions is just it's overkill.
And one of the training seminars going on here at the VA Council's convention relates to labor management partnerships, and that's obviously a very big issue for you. Talk a little bit about the labor management partnership.
Well,
aspect.
This is something that President Obama he put an executive order in, and we've talked about this before, which calls for a number of things. First of all, it calls for these forums where management and the union decision makers in management sit down together in a formal way to discuss issues that are affecting the particular agencies. And one of the big features of the executive order is the call for pre-decisional involvement. In other words, employees will have a voice while and before final decisions are made, that the whole decision-making process will be more open, and it'll allow the unions and to represent employees' concerns in some of these initiatives. It's really very exciting. I think a lot of managers are being pulled into this kicking and screaming, unfortunately, but even under the Clinton years with the partnership, we made a lot of really good advances for employees as well as for the mission of the agency. So it's it's business. It's a way of doing business, and it takes it out of the adversarial forum or us finding out something the day it's implemented, and then the only thing we can do is litigate the thing. This opens the process up so that there's no surprises, and we can have professional discussions with management on issues that affect our people.
In these forums, and as you mentioned, the pre-decisional involvement, how does that differ from years past?
Well, communications from the Bush administration was at an all-time low. There simply wasn't any. But even worse than that, a number of agencies really consolidated their labor management under a few headquarter attorneys, and they really forbade their operational managers in the field from sitting down with their union steward and solving problems. And it was a big step backward. Some agencies do that now and still, and it's really a self-defeating control issue that it doesn't work. It's never worked. And I think that healthy labor relations activities are when the union steward and the manager can sit down, you know, and work through a problem without making everything a federal case or driving it into the central offices of these agencies where, you know, lawyers who've never worked the jobs somehow are the interface with the unions. And every time we deal through these type of lawyers and try to get our voice or opinion heard by higher management, there's always this misunderstandings. We always lose in the misunderstandings. And, having one of these young lawyers interpret the union position ain't going to work, hadn't worked, won't work. And I think the forums are a great way of people sitting down face-to-face and having professional discussions. And I'll tell you, the managers, once they do it, they're going to like it.
Now, as you travel around the country and you talk to our membership, what is the feedback that you're getting on these forums?
Slow. The national forum that I sit on, I think, has done really a remarkable job. We're meeting every month religiously. We've moved through all the logistic things. Now we're starting to take on some issues, such as, telework. But the agencies, I mean, they put out the memos and things, but the going's been too slow in really revving up these forums at the workplace levels. But I guess anything new takes a minute or two to get set up. But, you know, we're, especially in the pre-decisional involvement, I mean, we have to make that part of the day-to-day labor relations. Not meeting, once every 6 months, as some of the forums, the lower forums have, put out. That's not going to do it. This pre-decisional involvement has to be part of the everyday fabric of the organization, and opening up these decisions and information that employees can weigh in. I think it's really, especially in the government. I mean, when people don't have the right information and confusion reigns and consistency goes down the pump, I mean, that takes away from our work. It really does.
Now, as you know, the last political cycle, there was a lot of talk about federal employees and pay and the size of government. What is your response to those allegations that federal employees are somehow paid more paid too much compared to the private sector?
Well, first of all, I was very disappointed in this in the election. Not necessarily the results, but the tone and the debate on the issues. I mean, when these soundbite bumper sticker solutions, after we're two wars going on and the stock market blowing up, and here we are, get government off our backs. I really don't know what that means, or we're going to take our government back, and I think people really don't have a good idea. Now maybe I'm wrong, but of what government is, and getting rid of government so our veterans come back, and instead of a quality VA hospital, they're going to get what? You know, there's always the then what? You know, food inspection, you know, get rid of it, then what? Social Security, Medicare, you know. And I'm always amazed. I saw that one Tea Party rally and a woman holding up a sign, keep your hands off my Medicare. I mean, that, you know, Medicare is a federal program and a good one. So, first of all, there's that. Now, and I think it's really disingenuous when certain candidates would talk about the deficit, which is certainly a real issue. And then say, well, we're going to cut federal pay. Like somehow that will make up the deficit. Yeah, maybe in 200 years, but it's just not a realistic thing. And why in the heck should federal employees, you know, when we're in a recession, federal employees and wars, federal employees' work goes up. You know, our VAs have a lot of business with the vets coming back. And Social Security. Anytime there's a recession, you know, the filings for disability and just skyrocket. So, and these people are, our people are working hard to keep those programs really working good, and they are very good programs. And so now to go back and say, okay, federal employees, take a 10% pay cut, I really think that's disingenuous, and I think it's dishonest. Our pay, despite the USA Today and these apple and oranges comparison that they make, is below that of the private sector. But even if it isn't, what is this thing that, okay, I don't have a job, therefore no one should have a job, you know, and we're going to those federal employees who their job is just too stable and we have to lower their pay. I just don't get that type of thinking, and it's certainly not aimed at solving any of our fiscal issues. I think it's just mean-spirited, and the only real outcome is going to be failure of these very important government programs, which are working people programs. You know, these programs were put in for working people. You know, I'm a billionaire, I don't think I need Social Security. You know, I don't really worry about Medicare that much. But for working people, it's these programs are essential. So we're into a big fight. I mean, clearly this new Congress is going to come with probably weekly digs at federal employees in the form of amendments and things like that. And we're really planning much more of an offensive to come out and let people know what those programs are and what they deliver to the American public, and that cutting them so that they can't operate is in no one's interest other than some of the big special interests in the country.
And as a former Social Security agency employee yourself, you know the important work that the agency does and how much that impacts someone who is reliant on a Social Security check every month.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we went through this before, and they start talking about closing down local Social Security offices, and the public reaction was swift and large. So cutting the operational budgets is of Social Security has really nothing to do with the fiscal impact of the overall program. I mean, you're going to need workers to administer that program, whether you raise the retirement age or lower benefit. I'm sure the politicians are going to be wrestling with that. But in the meantime, when you go and you hit Social Security's operating budget and have them lay off employees, or even furlough employees, that's a crusher, because then it sets back the quality and the service delivered by the agency. It really hurts. And people ought to know that is not going to solve this fiscal crisis. And I don't even know if it's a crisis, but this fiscal, balancing the budget by cutting Social Security employees' pay, it just doesn't add up.
And so How do you feel AFGE is going to go out and combat this in the years ahead?
The strength that we have is the quality of our service. Like the Washington Post, their survey that they had maybe a week before the election, which I didn't think was a real. I mean, the headline, of course, was people's trust in government are all time low or whatever. But then, as you drilled down in the survey and in the description of the survey, and you got to question 7 or 8 or so, and it says, have you had a personal interface with a government program? And the people who said yes, and they said, how'd it go? And people said, great. So there's a disconnect there. And it's all about jobs, but our job as a union is to really get out there and let people see what these programs are. And I don't mind using the word defend these programs and just get it in their mind that simple solutions or that are really based on an ideological hate for government, you know, whether it's good, bad, you know, I don't know where, when they say take our government back or take our country back, I don't know where that back is. You know, is it back to throwing our garbage over hills and outhouses? I mean, what are they, just what is the idyllic time in our history when that they want to get back to? So there's a lot of anger and frustration out there, but I'm just hoping that at some point facts will win out.
Well, we will certainly be keeping an eye on this in the years ahead. AFGE National President John Gage, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks, Dave.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason. Good to be back.
We've got you here today in Los Angeles at the VA Council's 20th Triennial Training Convention. Tell us about what you've seen so far.
Well, it's been a very exciting convention. Almost 500 people are registered here. They come from all of our VA locals, the medical centers, the regional offices, National Cemetery System, VA Central Office. This is the one time every 3 years. It's all of our VA membership about VA. So and you know, it's my home group. So obviously, I'm very, very attached to this council, and it's been great to visit old friends and remember old times, and also get excited about the good things we see happening for VA.
And as you said, as a former VA employee, this is kind of like old home week for you, right?
Oh, it clearly is. I was an officer in this council for many years, and it is. It's truly a home week to see so many people that I've been activist in AFGE for many, many years of my life.
Now, the convention here, they focus heavily on training, not just here, of course, at the convention, but throughout the year. Talk a little bit about the efforts to train and educate the members.
The VA Council, as well as AFGE, tries to spend a great deal of time on training its local activists in many areas. I mean, not just to represent employees and legislative things. There are training classes here on wellness, training classes, on things in general about the employment in the VA and where the VA is going, as well as we have specific training for our Title 38 activists, which is the registered nurses, physicians, and those employees, and again, master agreement training, which is one of the main purposes of our VA Council, is to negotiate a master agreement.
And talk a little bit about the Title 38 bargaining rights. That's a big issue right now.
That continues to be a big issue. We certainly have had some success in this past Congress. Well, and it still will go to a lame duck session here within another week. There was legislation voted out of committee in the Senate that would certainly improve part of the standings for Title 38 employees with their collective bargaining. This legislation has been endorsed by the Department of Veterans Affairs, and so we look forward to hopefully getting that passed in some final roll-up legislation this year.
And what do you think it will take to get that finally pushed through and taken care of?
It's going to clearly take a VA appropriations a piece of legislation passed through Congress, because that's the only vehicle that it could be attached to at this point. But it's very, very important legislation. Even the secretary has said to me personally, it is long overdue to correct part of these problems.
And expand upon it, upon what that legislation would do, what it would mean for employees at the VA.
This particular piece of the legislation would mean Title 38 employees who were not paid properly and had not been properly compensated would have the right to grieve and get action, that if they weren't paid properly, they could file a grievance, and with the resolve of that grievance, their pay would be corrected, as all Title V employees have. But currently, the VA will agree that the employee wasn't paid properly, and they should have been, but by the way, it's excluded by law, therefore, even though we agree we should pay you, we can't pay you.
And much like our transportation security officers, these bargaining rights, they're basic rights for employees.
They are basic rights that all federal employees have. It's a part of it because maybe by intent or by unintent, the way Congress passed the law has created these problems for these particular employees.
And to continue on with some of the legislative efforts of the council, what's it going to take to get full funding and staffing for the VA? I mean, we hear about crisis and nursing shortages all the time. What can we do to just finally reverse that trend?
Part of it, I think we are going to have to continue to educate the public. Many members that just recently ran for Congress ran on the platform to scale back government services, and are talking about not funding the VA. They want to send our men and women to war, but they don't want to take care of them when they come back with injuries and a lifetime effects from serving in that war. So funding the VA is a real, real issue and concern. We did make progress that we got the advanced appropriation bill passed by Congress, where they will have to at least fund a year in advance. But full funding of the VA is still in great danger, in my opinion, with the things that I have seen and the campaign promises that people were making over the last while.
You would have firsthand experience in this. What if someone came into your VA hospital and said, we're going to scale back 10% of your workforce? What would that have done to the services you were able to provide veterans coming home?
That would, number one, mean that 10% of the veterans would not be able to get care, and possibly even more than that. That means 10% of these people would continue to stand in line and wait and not receive care for traumatic brain injuries, not receive care for post-traumatic stress, not receive care for many, many injuries that they sustain. And again, also, that would have a big effect upon our older veteran populations. Every day, we have thousands of World War II veterans who are dying, but still yet there are thousands that need long-term care. Our Vietnam-era veterans, a lot of them would not receive care. It would be a terrible situation. There would be people literally dying in the streets without health care. Veterans, dying in the street without health care.
And we already hear of so many problems associated with veterans coming home, not getting the care that they need, and something ends up happening, such as maybe becoming a homeless veteran through no fault of their own, but simply not having been treated for things that they needed to be treated for. How could we possibly think about turning back even more?
Well, I mean, that's what's amazing to me, but that's what I heard in these past elections. Basically, no, we don't want to expand government services. We don't want to do for veterans. Government services, and government is good. Government does supply Social Security. Government does supply Medicare. Government, you know, keeps our borders safe. Government protects us from the criminals. Government does take care of veterans. There are government services, and government does a very, very good job and plays a very important role. And that's the thing with our federal employees. I mean, no matter who's in power and what the political process is, these folks get up every day, go to work, and take care and supply government services.
Now, while some are suggesting scaling back, AFGE is growing. And just as recently as May, the VA had a tremendous success rate with its organizing drive. Tell us about that drive.
Their success rate, they signed up over 7,000 new members from coast to coast. And this was a full gamut from physicians to housekeeping aides to claims examiners to nurses, all type of employees. And part of it is because I believe AFG is providing such excellent representation service to our VA members, and also is pushing hard to fund the VA and those type things to meet the mission of the VA. And the employees that work for the VA have a very, very strong sense of loyalty to that agency and to the veterans.
And explain to the audience what it means to have an additional 7,000 members behind you when you're trying to get something pushed through on the Hill, or you're trying to get a meeting with someone at the VA.
No matter what, I mean, anytime you have a 7,000 additional people, and we use pretty much a rule of thumb, each one of those individuals reaches out and touches at least four other folks. So now we're talking about 28,000 people that are being touched, be it an election for members of Congress, be it a community action, be it just spreading the word to people about what the VA does. I mean, there is strength in numbers. I mean, everything in the world always wants more members, be it the PTA, be it your local congregation of your church and synagogue. I mean, it's everybody always wants more members. So that's how the process, and there is strength in the numbers. Anytime you have more members, it makes you a stronger organization.
And as National Secretary Treasurer, that has been one of your primary focuses, is increasing the membership and continuing to organize, right?
Jason, everybody in AFG knows that's my cry, to organize. I'm a member of AFGE and been a member for a long time because someone asked me to join this union. And we find every day when we go out and we ask people to join our union, they join our union and they become strong activists in our union. So we have a real need to increase our membership, increase our visibility, increase our power and strength.
And what's the secret to success there? It's obviously not a magic pill, but it takes a lot of hard work and a lot of dedication. How has AFGE been so successful on that organizing front over the years?
Number one, our membership has dedicated resources to that. Our membership believes very strongly in the mission and the power of AFGE. It's our local activists. They take their own time, their own energy to go out to talk to people about joining the union, explain the benefits of union membership, and also that they spend a lot of time servicing that membership and hearing their concerns and trying to do something about it.
And back on the VA front for just a minute, talk a little bit about the claims process that one goes through as a recipient of benefits.
The claims process for veterans claims for service-connected disability is a very intense process. And part of it, number one, it has to be, because there has to be the medical documentation, there has to be the verification. that this person did receive this injury and that it has gotten worse as life has gone along. And there is no miraculous way to process these claims except by human people doing it. I mean, it seems crazy. We're in an electronic world nowadays where we're very much into pointing and clicking and believing that it all miraculously appears. But to process veterans' claims, it's all on-the-job training. There is no prerequisite that you can educate people to get them skilled to do that work. It's all on the job. It takes about 2 or better years for someone to enter the job and to become at a proficient level of processing the claims. And with the number of veterans that we are having, the number of injuries that's occurring in the two wars that we are fighting, so that claims process continues to go up and the numbers goes up. So it is a very, very complicated process, but it's also one that our members are very dedicated to processing.
And how important is it to be efficient in executing those claims?
Extremely efficient, because it's affecting someone's life, and it's affecting the money that they may have in their life. And the claim has to be adjudicated properly, the information evaluated properly. It's just not a fly-by-night process.
As we come into our last 30 seconds, where is AFGE and its VA Council going from here?
Well, the VA Council, they finalized their election process. Alma Lee was reelected as the national president. MJ, Mary Jean Burke, was reelected as first vice president. Oscar Williams as second vice president. William Bill Wetmore as third vice president, and Dorothy Jefferson as the treasurer. That is the team. There's been a resounding voice to reelect those people. They're going to move forward. We're going to see our VA Council continue to grow. I believe over the next 3 years, they will surpass over 100,000 members. They are in the process of finalizing a brand new master agreement. There are many, many good things happening for the VA, and the VA is a major component inside of AFGE. And President Gage and National Vice President Augusta Thomas and myself look very, very forward to continuing a strong relationship and working relationship with this council, as well as all of the other 12 National Vice Presidents.
And we will certainly be keeping an eye on the VA Council and its successes over the years. AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Jason. It's always a pleasure.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us, and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by AFGE 8th District National Vice President Jane Nygaard. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Now, we have you here today at the VA Council's 20th Triennial Training Convention. What is your reaction so far?
I think it's been a really good convention. The training's been excellent, and I think everyone is enjoying it.
What are some of the training events that have been put on here so far?
Well, they have a wellness event. They have a Title 38 training. Yesterday I was in a training that had to do with the nurse programs through the VA, which was very interesting. So just all kinds of different things, arbitration, you know, all kinds of different trainings.
Talk about that Title 38 training and how important that is to get those bargaining rights for those employees. I know that's been a fight for a long time.
Well, unfortunately, that wasn't part of the training. This was put on by central office, so these people are the people who don't want the 7422 collective bargaining rights for Title 38 employees. But what they are, this training was about was the different processes nurses have to go through for nurse professional standards board qualification, standards, et cetera, things for nursing and that.
And how important are those rights? I mean, these are basic worker rights, much in the same way that we're fighting for those rights for transportation security officers. I mean, these are just basic workplace rights for federal workers.
Yes, and the interesting thing is that the Title V or employees that work at the VA or the Title 38 hybrids have full collective bargaining rights. So if you're a registered nurse working on a ward, next to is an LPN, a licensed practical nurse who has full collective bargaining rights. If you're a psychologist who works with a psychiatrist, the psychologist has full collective bargaining rights, but the psychiatrist doesn't have any collective bargaining rights on certain issue areas. So it's kind of a ridiculous claim that they have that these people shouldn't have full collective bargaining rights because it would hamper or harm veterans care.
And is this something that could be fixed through a management decision? Does it need to be done legislatively? What are some solutions that could bring this thing to an end?
Well, I think it needs to be done legislatively because, you know, when we change off administrations, and I've been with the VA for a long time, you know, with the different administrations, there's a different process that they use to deal with whether or not something is going to be declared 7422. And so every 8 years, 4 years, or whatever, there's always the chance that you're going to go to a different way to deal with things. So it's best to just have legislation to fix it and move on.
And is that something that you think is on the horizon, or are we far off from that?
Well, we have a couple bills that have been introduced. One is a mini bill, and I don't remember the number right here, but that one just deals with pay issues under 7422, which we pay in compensation. The rest of it, the larger bill we have, which is S-362, and it's in the House also, that deals with all of the 7422, which is patient care, clinical competencies, peer review, and compensation. That one, we have a few sponsors, but, you know, it's difficult because people, the way the general public feels lately is that unions and collective bargaining rights are not a good thing, I guess. So it hasn't really gone too far.
And let's shift gears for a second. just recently, the USA Today had a report, again, criticizing the pay of federal workers. And this time, VA doctors were implicated in this. Could you talk a little bit about the reaction that you have from this in this report?
Well, I think the thing that is misleading is that, you know, in order to have a good qualified doctor, you're going to have to pay them an adequate salary. Our doctors are underpaid compared to the private sector, but most of them are there because they either like, you know, they have two dual sessions. Maybe they're researchers and they also have a practice, which could be primary care, could be a surgeon or whatever. So they have dual reasons why they're there. But so they're not going to pay as much as the private sector, but you're not going to get any type of a qualified doctor if you're not going to pay them somewhat of a decent salary. And I know that the VA struggled over the last few years to even get just plain radiologists in there. And I guess the public has to decide, you know, do you want good qualified doctors and clinicians to care for our veterans? I mean, I think they deserve that at the very least.
I guess you could hire a doctor for $50,000 a year in the federal sector, but what kind of doctor would you be getting at that rate?
Well, you're probably somebody that nobody else wants. You know, I mean, they say that a doctor, what's a doctor who's at the top of the list, and what's a doctor who's at the bottom? You know, I mean, you'd get the bottom of the barrel.
And there's a difference there. I mean, you start talking about quality of patient care, and nobody would go into a situation where their health is on the line and say, I'll settle for a substandard doctor who's making less money than another one.
And we don't want to go backwards. I mean, years previous, I mean, everybody's seen, I think that was the Tom Cruise film Born in America or something like that, but the point is that, you know, that's how they made the VA look like. It was like this dysfunctional hospital. We've now built it into a world-class healthcare system. As a matter of fact, they say it's the best in the nation because we really focus on preventative care rather than just reactive care. So we don't want to go backwards. We want to keep the VAs on the top of the line. We need to have qualified staff, highly qualified staff who really care for our veterans and want to be there, not just somebody who needs a job, but, you know, we want someone who cares about our veterans.
And it's been stated time and time again through surveys and studies that the VA healthcare system is the best in the world. So going forward, we're going to need to supply that healthcare system with top quality doctors. Now, the report says that doctors in the VA, their pay has gone up to about $179,000 a year. But we all know that top doctors in the private sector make twice that, at least.
Well, at least they do. And I mean, who doesn't think a doctor should make $179,000 a year? Like I said, I worked in the VA hospital for many years. I saw these guys come in as, you know, interns, then a residency program. By the time they get out, they're in their 30s. You know, I mean, they should get a decent salary so that they can at least have a decent life.
And no one goes into federal service with the mindset of cashing in, if you will. They're there for a mission, for a reason, to serve the public.
Right. Usually people who work at the VA, if they've been there for any length of time, they're there because of the veterans and they want to help the veterans and deliver care. People who don't want to do that, they only last a few years and they're gone.
And so I guess the million-dollar question is, how do we change this perception? I mean, we see these, we're in a time now where the size of the federal government and the people who serve the federal government are under fire. How do we change that perception?
I think the VA has to, and the unions can do this too, we have to educate the public. I mean, the VA hospitals nationwide track incidents of that are, we have patient safety that we track. You know, if there's a medication error, we track all that. The private sector doesn't track their errors. We do. And then we learn from our errors. We do what we call a root cause analysis, see what we can change to make things better. And that's what we need to let people know, is that we are a world-class system. We do track everything, and we try to make the changes that are necessary to make us the best.
And talk about the work of federal employees as a whole. I think whenever these kinds of reports come out, they're very vague, and they don't give a lot of detail in terms of the work that federal employees do. Talk a little bit about the valuable work that a federal employee does every day.
Well, depending upon which agency, I mean, we have our meat inspectors. I mean, it's amazing what those people do. People don't even think about it, but I mean, the fact that they can, you know, actually examine these animals as they are going on through a slaughterhouse is amazing. We also have a huge research facilities that deal with viruses. We have one in Ames, Iowa. This is a world reference lab where all over the world people send stuff to this facility, and we have veterinarians there and researchers that look at ways to cure viruses from across the world. You know, that we got our border patrol, which guards our borders. We got the Bureau of Prison, which takes care of our prisoners and, you know, make sure that we're safe and they're locked up. So, I mean, you could go from Social Security. I mean, it's just, you could go on and on. We do tons of stuff that's very positive. Even Hoover Dam, I mean, where AFG represents them there, the employees there, and that's where they sell electricity. I mean, it's amazing what we do. And the general public is totally unaware. I don't think they have any idea what the federal government does.
Yet they are dependent on the services of the federal government in some way, whether you go through an airport and interact with a transportation security officer, or you are picking up your Social Security check, or you're a veteran who's seeking care, or you live in a community where a Bureau of Prisons facility resides. And that's a great example. You know, the Bureau of Prisons is already understaffed as it is. Cutting back more puts the community at risk, doesn't it?
Absolutely, because, I mean, if there's not enough guards to keep the prisoners locked up or, to keep them from having an attack or whatever, I guess, or a coup, that would definitely impact the neighborhood.
And so coming into our last minute here, what are your final thoughts on maintaining the proper perspective on federal employees and the valuable work that they do?
Well, I think it would be nice if any of these newspapers, I mean, whether it be the U.S. News or Washington Post or whatever, if they'd actually look at true facts about federal employees. And like this instance of the article today about $179,000, it'd be nice if they would have compared that to what a private sector doctor makes. But they don't want to do that because they don't want the general public to know the truth. So somehow if we could get the message out that, you know, federal employees are not overpaid. I mean, we have a lot of people that make $20,000 or less, depending upon whether they're a nursing assistant or a housekeeper or whatever. We need to somehow have the newspapers be honest, I guess, and I don't know how you do that.
Well, we'll certainly be keeping an eye on this in the months ahead. AFGE 8th District National Vice President Jane Nygaard, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National President John Gage, National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, 8th District National Vice President Jane Nygaard, and Membership and Organization Department Director Sharon Pinnock. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, Dell, and